why it's so important for you to participate during class, so that you can hear other voices, other people can hear other voices. On a quarter when I'm teaching and preaching, you have to hear me twice. So. Give us a king. Give us a king. A famous request by the Israelites in 1 Samuel 8. That's where we'll begin this lesson this morning. I love to preach from a single book of the Bible, as you probably have noticed, and sometimes working topically, you know, across different books of the Bible versus preaching expository or textual sermons, sometimes those are contrasted. They're different, obviously, but really, when we come to a text, there is a topic. There is a topic for us to apply. And really, I should say that with these lessons that I'm taking out of 1 Samuel, they're not really the same as like I normally would do, like through John, where I'm taking a smaller section and working kind of paragraph by paragraph or verse by verse. I'm really just grabbing a larger section and drawing just the things that are focused on the particular topic that we're focusing on. And that is this idea that we are united as people who have a common mission, that we are comrades. And so that's what brought me to 1 Samuel. That's what brought me there, because I just knew that there was a good amount to work from with this idea of us having a mission, us having a common mission. So what we've seen so far in 1 Samuel, that first large chunk that we sampled, was that they had lost sight of what even the mission was. You're looking at what they're doing and how they're behaving and how they're thinking, and it's, what is their goal here? They were going into battle as people who were not faithful to the Lord, looking for success of some sort, but not having been changed as being God's people, God's righteous people, and they were defeated. But they thought they can use the ark as a kind of talisman, as a kind of magic box to rescue them, because now their God is with them. Now their God would have been with them if they had repented and sought him rather than just trying to use him for their own mission, for their own glory. And they so lost sight of God's glory and God's mission that they lost the glory of God to an extent. They came to a point in which we saw the language of the word Ichabod, that they had, that God's glory had departed. And even as they begin to be the kingdom of God, a more complete kingdom, the true mission continues to be at stake. So let's look here in 1 Samuel chapter 8. They've had Samuel as their leader and judge. We saw him in the earlier years there, in early chapters of 1 Samuel. And that's been great. But Samuel has fallen short, unfortunately, sadly, as a father. Similar to Eli, his sons aren't like him. They took bribes and perverted justice. Text tells us serious. The people see this and they are ready for a change. Judges were great as limited, local, and temporary leaders and deliverers, but they wanted something more. And I don't think we are supposed to completely fault them for wanting this. It wasn't all bad to want a king. It's the particular version of that they want that is so bad. So what is it they want? Let's read verses 4 and 5 for Samuel 8, 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." A king. There's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with a king. It was God's plan for them to have a king. It was God's promise, even. To Abraham in Genesis 17:6, God promised that nations would come from him, kings would come from him. Now, in fact, kings had already come from Abraham, because other nations had come from Abraham. Edom, Esau, they had kings already, others as well. But kings would come from Abraham. That was part of the promise. Part of being a nation that he had promised them. And in Genesis 49, Jacob is blessing his children, and what you see there, though, is not just a blessing from Jacob, but you really see God's plan communicated through Jacob for his sons. And of Judah, it says in 49 verse 10, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet." Sounds like a king. That God's plan, before anyone else, before Israel existed, God's plan was for Israel to have a king. But God didn't just tell them that a king would come. He also communicated what kind of king they were to have. If you study Genesis, I think by looking at Judah himself, the man that is given this blessing, you begin to see what kind of king God's looking for and the way that Judah changes. But he talks about it more specifically, directly, in Deuteronomy 17. Again, this is before Israel even has the land, as they're prepared to go conquer the land in Deuteronomy 17, verse 14. You can go ahead and turn there. I'll turn there as well. He's given them a lot of laws in Deuteronomy that pertain to living in the land. Sometimes I think Deuteronomy is neglected because it's just Leviticus and Exodus, all that all over again, but it's really not. Deuteronomy 17, verse 14 is some instruction that they have not been given, that's not been recorded for us prior to this. "When you come to the land the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it, and dwell in it, then say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me. You may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests, and it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes, and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel." So God anticipated their desire for a king. God planned for them to have a king before he gave them the land, and then he specifically calls out their desire for a king like the nations around them. But God says, no, it needs to be someone I choose, someone who follows the commands of the true. So what's so wrong about desiring a king like the nations? I think you can understand it. If you put yourself there in Israel in the time of the judges, all this time of instability, oppression, other nations having it better than you have it, other nations who trust in false gods, by the way, other nations who maybe aren't occupied by the Philistines and subject to periodical raids, other nations that have other nations under their thumb instead of being under everyone else's thumb. But then you have to ask yourself, why would they want to be like those nations? Those nations, in some cases, are where they are because of their wickedness. You want to be like the Philistines? Well, you want to be like the Philistines because they're on top. But the Philistines are the ones who are treating you unjustly, that are oppressing you. Philistines are the ones who are trusting in these idols. The nations are wicked and idolatrous. And Israel's mission wasn't to be like the nations, but quite the opposite. In seeking God's glory, they were to be a blessing to the nations. The influence was supposed to go the other way. So it shouldn't have been, we wanted a king like the nations. But they should have had a mission not to let the nations influence them, but to influence the nations. That promise to Abraham, remember in Genesis 12, God was going to bless Abraham. But as some have put it succinctly, Abraham was blessed to be a blessing. Israel was blessed to be a blessing. And that distinction between just being blessed and this state of blessing from God versus going out and being a blessing to others, influencing others for good, that's the difference between just status as God's people and mission as God's people. It's the state of having been saved, blessed by God, and just existing in that state versus realizing that, no, the whole point of being moved from darkness into light, of the whole point of saving us, was so that we'd be active in influencing others, carrying his mission forward. So Israel still had the wrong sense of mission. They were prioritizing their position in the world first, their own security, their own situation. They should care, I think, some extent, about the fact that they're in hard times. They should notice that they're oppressed and not be too excited about that. But they need to then seek the solution in the Lord and seek their king. Trust in him. You'd think they had to figure this out during the time of the judges. Things were bad. If they turned away from God, when they cried out to God, God would bless them. It was God who would rescue them. Well, let's go ahead and read 1 Samuel 8, 6 through 9, as we see how Samuel, but more importantly, how God feels about this. The thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds that they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, that they also are doing, so they also are doing to you. Now then obey their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them." They aren't interested in what kind of king God would give them. They have chosen the kind of king they want. And they're rejecting God as their king in this move by seeking a king like the nations. But I think what's going to happen here is that God is giving them what they've asked for. He's letting them have it. And so he tells Samuel to warn them ahead of time. We're going to get a taste of two distinct things. God's plan for them to have a king, we'll get a taste of eventually, but their idea of having a king like the nations is going to come first. The king that is like the nations, Samuel will tell them, is a king who will lord it over them, the king who will take their land, their children, and accumulate wealth and power to the hurt of his own people. And this really sad thing is said in verse 18 of chapter 8. "In that day, you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." Just a chapter earlier, chapter 7, we covered in our last sermon, Samuel was asked by the people, "Don't stop crying out to God for us," and we're told that God answered Samuel's cries, and they were victorious in battle. But when they've chosen this kind of king for themselves, and that king is everything that they first were trying to be rescued from in the first place, when that king is corrupt and oppressive, and they cry out to God, God says, he won't answer them. Well, let's see what kind of king they get here. In chapter 9, things move kind of gradually here. Verse 1, there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Bechorath, son of Aphia, a Benjamite, a man of wealth. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. Saul, if you're reading in Hebrew, there may be an intentional pun of the situation here, or an observed pun here, that they've asked for a king, and his name is Ask. So this is what they've asked for, Saul. The word Saul sounding like the Hebrew word for ask. This is what they've asked for. Well, he's from a lowly tribe. If you're reading the story of the Bible, he's from Benjamin, a tribe that barely survived the period of the Judges. It was almost totally wiped out by its own people, by the other tribes, because of its sin, trying to purge sin from the nation. But also from a wealthy family, even though from a lowly tribe. And he's tall and he's handsome. When Samuel introduces him in chapter 10, he highlights Saul's physique. I find this odd. Chapter 10, verse 23, and when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? This is one, there is none like him among all the people. And all the people shouted, long live the king. Do you see him? Look at him. There's no one like him. Now, I'm not one to be wanting to criticize Samuel here, but as you read through the whole book, really 1 and 2 Samuel, one book, but as you read through the whole story, I think we are meant to see a mistake being made here by Samuel. There's this contrast between the way Saul is seen and the way David is seen by Samuel. And so later, when Saul's being replaced and David's being anointed secretly, in chapter 16, verse 7, When different sons of Jesse, brothers of David, are brought before Samuel, it's the oldest brother, surely this is the guy. And then the next brother, the next brother, the next brother, oh, this is the guy. Just look at him. But then God specifically has to tell Samuel, chapter 16, verse 7, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So when you kind of reread 1 Samuel, you reread Saul's situation, and all this talk about just how tall and handsome he is, it's hard for me to see that in a positive light, that they would be preoccupied and say, well, just look how kingly he is. Someone to lead us in battle. The Lord sees not as man sees. So they're looking for someone who's tall, good-looking. Well, they can have it. They've got that. That doesn't say anything negative about Saul, of course. He does appear to be humble early on. He doesn't jump at the opportunity to be king when he learns of that. I'm sure by surprise from Samuel. It doesn't look like he's just excited to tell everyone about that. When he goes home to his father, he does not disclose that part of Samuel's message. When it's time to anoint Saul, he is nowhere to be found. They have to go find him hiding among baggage. But I'm not sure if humility is the fundamental thing here. I think there's something more consistent across Saul's life, and that's fear. I understand why you could be afraid to be recognized as king in Israel. Can you imagine? I don't know. Finding yourself, put yourself in the American Revolution, and we're going to declare, imagine they declared their independence from England by making George Washington president. Okay, go. Well, that's not exactly how it worked out, I don't think. But how would you like to be George Washington in that scenario? The way we're going to communicate our rebellion and our seeing ourselves as an independent sovereign nation is by putting this president forward. Well, I wouldn't want to be him. I think that's the kind of situation that's really going on here with the Philistines. The Philistines have garrisons. You read about it. It's like every chapter, it seems like, well, they went by the garrison of the Philistines. They're just all over. They are occupied. They are an occupied nation. And now, and as an occupied nation, you are going to say that you have a king? You want to be that king? Frightening. That takes courage that Saul does not have. I think that comes more clear as we read more about him and in contrast to others. But he's afraid. And I think we'll see that, yeah, we'll see that working in him here in his downfall. And so, again, we really are just jumping through things here, but jumping over to the chapter 13. I should note before this that in chapter 12, when Samuel's speaking of Saul, he talks about him as the one whom you have chosen. He tells them how they need to fear the Lord, how the king needs to obey the voice of the Lord, and they need to follow a king that follows the Lord. Makes that very, very clear for them. But pretty quickly, Saul begins to stray. And so, just for some context, before reading a specific part of this, there have been increasing conflicts with the Philistines. Saul's son, Jonathan, keeps doing this kind of thing, courageously takes a Philistine garrison. I think Jonathan is part of why I see Saul is so fearful. Jonathan keeps doing things out of courage and faith in the Lord that Saul is not ready to do. And that escalates the conflict as Jonathan engages the Philistines. The Philistines muster an army to fight Israel. Saul gathers some people in Gilgal, and they are waiting. They want to be able to defend themselves against the Philistines that have gathered. But they're waiting. They're going to offer a sacrifice to God. Waiting for Samuel is instructed by him. They can, before going into battle, they can petition God. They can ask for his help, protection, and whether or not even to go, perhaps, into battle to honor the true king. Back in chapter 9, there was a subtle point made that prepared us for this. It's a fun thing that you might find in the Bible sometimes, where you read something, it seems like a minor detail, like, okay, and then later you see, oh, that's why we're told that. Chapter 9, verse 13, when Saul's first being told about Samuel by the people in that town, he's told, yeah, Samuel, you'll see him in town. He'll be coming soon. And the people, they always wait for him. They always wait for him before having offering and going on and eating. Well, that's interesting. They always wait for him. Well, not in Saul's case. Saul does not wait for Samuel. He offers a sacrifice because, look, the Philistines are upon us. We've been waiting, just like he said, for 7 days. Samuel's not here. It's a seventh day. And the people are starting to scatter. We're breaking apart. So verse 10 of 1 Samuel 13, finally there. As soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and greet him. And Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "When I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash, I said, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the favor of the Lord.' So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." Samuel said to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God with which he commanded you, for then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. The Lord has commanded him to be the prince over his people, because you have not kept the Lord, what the Lord commanded you." Saul was focused on not dying, and being victorious in battle, seeking the Lord's favor. He wants to make sure that happens before they go into battle. It's a little like securing the ark, I think. Seeking the Lord's favor, but not honoring him in obedience. Samuel did come within the appointed boundaries of time. Seventh day he arrived, right after Saul gives the sacrifice. It's funny, that's how often faith works, is that things can feel right at their breaking point, and if we just held on a little longer, trusted in the Lord, he would have come through. Saul was so focused on his fear and the fear of the people as they were leaving that he forsook his faith. He disobeyed the command of the true king. And this is the king they asked for. Something similar happens the second time there in chapter 15. And there are important things in chapter 14 as well, again showing a contrast between Jonathan and Saul and the mess that Saul creates. Let's continue on. Chapter 15, just summarize some things leading up to verse 10. He's given orders, a mission. Okay, this is a big deal. There's this people called the Amalekites or Amalekites, whatever you prefer. And they are people who opposed Israel when Israel was vulnerable coming out of Egypt. They were not a trained army. They were coming out of Egypt, and the Amalekites went out against them. God remembered that and was going to judge them one day. And so this is a big deal. Saul's mission as the first king in Israel is to go finish the job. Go take out the Amalekites. Devote them to destruction. Something we saw early on the conquest when Joshua was going through and just destroying. There were a handful of cities that were to be destroyed completely. God would give them all kinds of spoil of war later. God would give them houses already built and fields already planted. But these first ones were supposed to be devoted to God. Well, that's what Saul is supposed to do with the Amalekites. But he doesn't quite do that. We talked about that some in the authority class. It's kind of like a whole burnt offering, where you take a whole lamb or a whole ram or something, and you burn the whole thing on the altar, and the priests don't get to eat any, you don't get to eat any, like some of the sacrifices allow. The whole burnt offering was just this complete dedication to God. This is for God completely. That's what this was supposed to be. But he doesn't do that. Let's read verse 10 through 23 of chapter 15. The word of the Lord came to Samuel, "I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments." And Samuel was angry, and he cried to the Lord all night. And Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning, and it was told Samuel, "Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he has set up a monument for himself, and turned and passed on and went down to Gilgal." Samuel came to Saul and said to him, "Blessed be you to the Lord. I performed the commandment of the Lord." Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen that I hear?" Saul said, They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have devoted to destruction." Then Samuel said to Saul, "Stop. I will tell you what the Lord said to me this night." And he said to him, And Samuel said, "Though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go devote to destruction the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed.' Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord?" And Saul said to Samuel, "I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I've gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me. I've brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and I've devoted the Amalekites to destruction." The people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord, your God, in Gilgal. And Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry, because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king. Oh, Saul. Hard to read that and not get a little bit of a scolding parent voice there. Stop. Stop, Saul. I did it. No, you didn't do it. He, I think, has convinced himself that he's done exactly what God had asked, and I'm sure very excited about the success that they've had. But he just didn't. He didn't completely obey the Lord, which was the whole point of what mission he was sent on, to completely destroy all of this. This is the king they've asked for. Look, I'll make some applications here before bringing it to conclusion. We don't get to pick and choose when and how we obey him. When he has spoken clearly, we better obey exactly. Saul needed to devote the Amalekites entirely to destruction, and we need to devote our lives completely as a living sacrifice. Is there any aspect of our lives that aren't completely devoted to him, that aren't under jurisdiction, under Jesus' jurisdiction? He is king completely over us, and so our whole lives are commandeered for his mission. So those are two examples I want to sample as things that we might kind of tuck away that aren't under God's authority. Two areas, I think, where this tends to happen. One is my personal life. So here's a specific example. I remember talking to someone who had recently been baptized. This is a situation where I don't think faith was operating in his decision to be baptized. And most people, I think, who knew him didn't think that either. And I remember talking to him about something very personal, about lust. And I remember talking to him about suggesting a tool, a software that is accountability software that can monitor your internet usage. And his response to that was, that no one has the right to know what I do on my phone. God is king. You've committed yourself to the Lord. That belongs to him. So personal life is an area where we might not be inclined to think about God's authority as readily. Another area is God's authority over the world and in the world. In the world that we see and that we hear about and that we argue about. So here's a specific example. Sometimes there are people who, when they hear talk of racism or racial injustice in the world, the reaction is, well, we're not about that stuff. And you go back in history, people can debate the relevance of that today, but most people agree in history that it has been very relevant for us and for our country. But in history, people were making that same point. Ah, this is a distraction. We're not about that. We're not about whether or not people can own slaves. We're not about whether or not Jim Crow laws are just or unjust. Those kinds of arguments were made by Christians. Jesus is king. Our whole lives are devoted to him. So my personal life, how I use my phone, and what I think about racial injustice belong to God, and Jesus gets to speak to those things. And it is a common mission between us. We can talk about those things together. This is a common mission. We are all at work for the same king, a king who speaks to my personal life, who speaks to evil in the world. and we work on that together. And we can talk about those things together. There's nothing off limits. Jesus is king over all, and we devote our whole lives to him. So that's one point of application. Second thing is, we must not set up our own king, a king like the nations. The way we do what we want to do in our lives is by rejecting God as king. We are rejecting God as king when we do it our own way, setting up our own king. It really is going to be ourselves. The truth is, the most attractive life to you and to me is not perfectly in line with the life that God has for us to live. I know that because none of us are fully sanctified. None of us are fully righteous. We're not fully transformed. We're not perfected yet. And so what I would like of my life and the way I would live it is just not exactly what God wants. So I need to recognize that the way that I justify living a life that's different than he wants is by following different rulers, by setting up my own kings, different authorities that I want to follow that rule my life rather than him. Something in my life that allows me to have the right mix of godly ideals and some sacrifices here that make me feel okay, but then really just ultimately living the way that I want to live. Following Jesus is going to require sacrificing the way that I want my life to be and not setting up our own kings. And then finally, we've seen this thing of idea of faith versus fear here, which we've heard a lot about this year, faith versus fear, but that ought to have been a theme in our lives in all realms. What drives your life? What makes us want to find something secure, a king like the nations? The kings of the earth, they want fear to drive you. You just watch one political ad, and you've got a good sense that fear is supposed to be driving us to the rulers of the world. Doing things out of fear means we are not doing them from faith. Look ahead of you. See the threats. And cry out to the Lord who leads people who trust in him. We don't have to be afraid. There are things that we might describe as fearful things, but be courageous. The Lord is with you. Jonathan, in the passage we skipped, talks about how God is with us whether there's few or many, right? So we got this. We can go fight this garrison, just me and this buddy, because God's with us. That's the difference. Did you notice back in chapter 13 when Saul went ahead and offered the sacrifice and couldn't wait for Samuel? It wasn't just Saul's sin. Obviously, that's where the focus is. He is responsible. He is the king. But Israel is supposed to be together in following the Lord. That's what Samuel told them when he gave them the king. You need a king that follows the Lord, and you need to follow the Lord too. They are responsible. And though it was wrong for Saul to put it on them, well, they were leaving, so I had to do this, it is true that they shouldn't have been scattering out of fear. Fear divides us. Fear brings us to react to our circumstances, to go our separate ways, our own various solutions to the problem. But we need to hold together by faith in him. So here's the bad news, though. And it's always the bad news when you talk about application in a sermon. It's bad news because when we talk about the ideals of what we should be, we are also exposing of what we are not, what we failed to be, and what we will fail to be and fail to do in some ways. So it's bad news. We failed to devote our lives entirely to Jesus. We have set up our own kings, and we have acted out of fear instead of faith. But here's the good news. 1 Samuel doesn't just have kings falling. But the next thing you find is that God has found a king after his own heart. David is being anointed. But of course, you know not just to stop at David. because if you stop there, you're going to be disappointed. David will see his flaws as well. But we look to the greater son of David. Jesus is the king chosen by God, and it's not that we have to go without a king. We should be afraid if that's our situation, that we are just supposed to rule ourselves. We will fail if we're just supposed to rule ourselves. We do want a king. It was God's plan from the beginning for us to have a king. The Lion of Judah, who is to topple the kings we have set up in our hearts, and who is to rule over us and lead us and conquer our battles. So don't be afraid. Jesus is king. He is able.